writer and director Levin Aiken is a Georgian-Swedish director who had an international breakthrough 4 years ago with his film And Then We Danced. He joins us now to discuss his latest feature, Crossing, which tells the story of Leah, played by Georgian actor Mzia Arabuli, a retired unmarried history teacher who goes on a mission to find her missing niece, a trans woman called Tekla, who has crossed the border into Turkey and may now be in Istanbul. Leah promised Tekla's dying mother she would find her daughter and bring her home. Crossing brings us themes of kinship, friendship and acceptance, explored through on-screen friendships between Leah and her unlikely travel companion, Achi. In Istanbul, we meet Evrim, a trans woman who acts as the advisor to others in her community while tackling the daily challenges and dangers of being a member of that community. Crossing recently won the Teddy Jury Award at the Berlin International Film Festival, and I'm delighted to be joined by the director, Levin Aiken. Levin, you're so welcome to Arena.
Thank you for having me.
Now, like your previous film, And When We Dance, Crossing begins in Georgia, a country you have strong ties with. Why did you choose to have your two central characters Georgian?
I think this film was very much a reaction to my last film, And Then We Danced, because when we tried to screen And Then We Danced in Georgia, there was a great deal of turmoil and demonstrations and things like that. So it felt very natural for me to set this story through a Georgian lens, too. I wanted to continue that conversation.
Yes, and Then We Danced was a gay love story between two dancers, and that caused all kinds of controversy in Georgia itself.
Yes.
In some respects, Crossing is a road trip with, as I said, two very unlikely companions, Leah, the retired history teacher, and this local boy, Achi. Why are they both going to Istanbul, if you could bring us into the story?
Sure. First of all, story-wise, I wanted two characters that sort of represented two polar opposites of Georgian society. One is the older Soviet generation, and then you have this younger kid who's this post-Soviet generation. And they have, you know, different views on the world and so forth. So that was something that I wanted to bring into the story. And I feel like both of these characters have more in common than they perhaps understand to begin with. Leah is a woman, you know, who probably at some point in her life didn't want to subjugate herself to a man. She doesn't have any children. And then you have Achi on the other end, who lives in this sort of very toxic masculine environment with his older brother. And he sees Leah as a way to escape his home by traveling with her to Istanbul.
And it's with Achi's parents, family, and Leah, we get the first indication of Tekla being a trans woman and how trans people are disrespected in Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, when the film begins, the sense is that Leah has this mission to accomplish. She's almost like a character in a Western movie who has this one last mission before she's just going to lay down and die, essentially, is sort of the idea she has in her own mind. And then as the film progresses, you know, she sees different sides of this community that she, you know, knows very little about, and evolves accordingly.
Yes, I think the Western is a very good metaphor, because Istanbul is a crazy place when they arrive, these two people. They go there by, there's a bus journey, then there's a ferry journey, and then they go into this mad world. And it is the blind leading the blind, because Achi doesn't know any more than Leah does about Istanbul.
No, he tricks her. And I mean, Istanbul is a very fascinating place. I wanted the audience to feel, you know, when I watch films, I love going on a journey. Film to me is like traveling. And I wanted to immerse the viewers in this wonderful place, Istanbul, and, you know, to really feel the sense of the city and the scope of it and all of its lives and cats and everything.
Yes, we'll get back to the cats in a moment. But the interesting place that that they do go to is the area where, a very poor area, obviously, where trans women live. And it's very, you know, falling down houses and people living in obvious poverty. I know you worked with NGOs to find and discover and communicate and make sure that the world you were creating, this world where trans women live, was true. So how did you find that area? How did you find the community? And what did you find there?
It's interesting with Istanbul because there's so many, you know, pockets in that city. It's an incredibly diverse city. You could make 50 different movies and show 50 different Istanbuls that, you know, you would have a hard time believing were even the same city. What's interesting with this pocket that I'm showing in the film is that it's actually very close to one of the liveliest commercial streets in Istanbul called İstiklal Street. And literally, like in the movie, you walk that very lively street that has, you know, everything from McDonald's to Starbucks and is a regular, you know, street. And then you just go a few meters, 10, 20 meters in on the side street. And then you are in this area. So everything is very much on top of each other. And I actually have passed that street myself many times when I've been to Istanbul, even before I decided to make this film. So it is a space that is very sort of available and not something that's out in the fringes somewhere.
And your character then that you, I mean, we have two great characters who are on this crusade together, even with different objectives. And then into this, you bring a third character, the character of Evrim. And she is a trans woman and she has been through, you know, she goes through all the, I suppose, the challenges of being a trans woman in Istanbul, which shows little tolerance. And then, but she's also an advocate for other trans women. Where did you get that character from?
She is very much an amalgam of several women that I met while I was doing research in Istanbul. And I was actually one of the first women I did meet worked for an NGO called Red Umbrella in Ankara. And she, just like Evrim, was an activist, a human rights lawyer. And I was just struck by sort of the resilience of these women and how they navigated this quite hostile patriarchal environment with such optimism. And that they were so sort of not at all ready to hide or cower in fear of anyone. They stood their ground. And I felt that that was such an inspiring thing and something that I really wanted to show in this film.
Yes, because she's a stunning character, tall, statuesque, very confident, even though everything is thrown at her in terms of, you know, difficulty. But she as a character shines in the film.
I agree. I'm very much enamored with her, both the actress and the character. And someday, somehow, maybe it would be fun to make more stories about Evrim because she's, you know, she lives a very interesting life in Istanbul.
Now, there are the obvious insults in the streets that she gets, but there's also the bureaucracy. Could you just tell us a little bit about this? She goes into a hospital and has to get all these forms signed.
Yes. So in Turkey, in order to transition fully legally, you need something called a pink ID. Actually, it's not pink anymore, but it used to be. Now it's you know, both IDs have the same color. But before, the female was pink and the man was blue. And that in itself says a lot, I think. But and essentially, you have to, it's super bureaucratic. You have to go through every department at the hospital, at a hospital, and the doctors at these departments have to sign an approval notice that they've gone through you, look at your body, etc., psychology tests, blah, blah, blah. And then they say, okay, you are a woman, or no. So it's very much dependent on the mood of these people, and it's very much how you're seen as a woman through the lens of a man. So often you have to be very, very overly feminine. You have to, you know, also be pleasing to a man, et cetera, et This can take a very long time to do because it's not, you know, there's no, you can't make any appointments. You just literally have to run around and knock on these doors. And then after that, you have to go and stand in front of a judge who gives the final approval.
Oh my goodness, that in itself is epic, isn't it?
Yeah, that's like a film in itself. There's actually a documentary about that that I've heard about. I haven't seen it. I need to figure out what it's called. But somebody mentioned to me that there's a documentary on the topic.
And now, the way you went about casting this is intriguing. First of all, there's Leah, who has Anna Magnani all over her. She's this strong, fabulous older woman. But then Achie and Evram, how did you go about casting those characters? The young, scareaway young fella, and then this trans woman who is really quite very central in your film.
Sure. So essentially everyone in the film except Leah and the taxi driver and two of the policemen, they're actors and they have, you know, an actor's education. But the rest of the characters in the film are amateurs, real people, you know, whatever you want to call them. I always think that once they step in front of the camera, they become actors.
Of course.
But, you know, they're not actors to begin with. And we have, you know, it was a very arduous process finding all of these characters. And it took a long time. We did this during COVID. So all of the spaces that we would usually go to were not readily available. We had a trans man. His name is Bulut, who was our main casting agent in Turkey, who cast all of the trans roles, among others. So that was very helpful. But it was a very, very long process to find these, especially the three lead characters.
Yes, and I heard you got a great video from Achie's the actor who plays Achie.
Yes, he sent, he did his own video, a self-tape, where he was working in a beauty salon at the time in Tbilisi. And he was incredible in that self-tape. Yes, there is so much talent out there. You just have to keep looking.
Now, you talked about how Istanbul is just waiting for millions of films to be made there. But there are these gentle moments that you get, this preponderance of cats that are in Istanbul and who come at various times and give consolation to some of the characters. Is that something that's in Istanbul? Cats, wild cats everywhere?
Yeah, they're everywhere. It's almost like a Where's Waldo when you look at the film? Even I now, when I watch it, sometimes see more cats. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's a cat up there. There's a cat hiding under the car there. They're everywhere. And the scene when the cat goes and sits in Evrim's lap was art by accident. Those cats are at that hospital. It was something I was very fascinated by when I was there doing research, you know, that they had all the cats were all inside the hospital. And it just jumped up into her lap and she reacted accordingly. So they were very helpful, those kitties.
Obviously, the controversy and the backlash surrounding When We Danced, it didn't put you off going into territory that's controversial.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the contrary, it bolstered me because I realized really firsthand the power of images in cinema. You know how fascists always, the first thing they do is shut down, you know, art and TV and everything when they take over. So I was like, wow, that's why they do it. because, you know, it has power. So I felt more bolstered to keep exploring this topic from this region.
And any reaction from Georgia yet to Crossing?
I mean, the sort of conservative, very conservative, extreme right-wing Christian, they're always going to, whatever I do, I could make a film about that's not even on a queer topic, and they would still find something to, since And Then We Dance. So, but we haven't released it there yet, so we're trying to lay low for a while.
Well, thank you very much for talking
thank
to
you.
Us, Levin. Thank you. That's Levin Aiken, the director of Crossing, and it's in Irish cinemas from Friday the 19th of July and streaming platforms Mubi from August the 30th. Sunny is the new series from Apple TV that stars Rashida Jones as Susie Sakamoto, a woman whose husband and son are presumed dead in a plane crash. As a consolation, her husband's firm give her a domestic robot called Sunny to be a companion, a robot Susie hates.
I don't want a pet. I don't want a robot. I hate robots.
May I ask why?
Because they're creepy.
Oh.
But robots are expressions of their creators. Sunny was created by your husband. You do not find Martha creepy.
Not till now.
I hope that is not true, Susie-san. The Martha I know is a good man. And I believe he would take comfort in knowing you have Sunny. Please. Martha would take great comfort.
Okay, fine. I'll keep it. Just tell me how to turn it off.
Yes, Sunny is science fiction set in the near future Japan. Yes, it's about robots, but it is also about grief and wondering if we can ever truly know another person. The intriguing thing about the series is that it's based on a novel by Irish writer Colin O'Sullivan called The Dark Manual. Colin lives and works in Japan, and I'm delighted to be joined by him. Colin, The Dark Manual is your third novel. It's set in Japan and you live in Japan. Tell me, what was the reason you moved to Japan in the first place?
The original idea was just to go for a year abroad, you know, a little excursion, a little bit of life experience to go teaching abroad for a year. I didn't realize 20 or so years later I'd be still here. That wasn't in the plan. So it started out as an adventure, and then I just got settled, got married with two kids now, and I've been here a long time. And yeah, just part of the furniture now, I guess.
And you're a teacher, and then you write in the evenings. Is that right? Or has that changed since Sunny?
I'm a teacher from Monday to Friday, and then Saturday and Sunday are my writing days. I'm a weekend writer, a morning writer. I'm up early in the morning on a Saturday with a coffee on, and then I'm hard at it for as long as I can take it on a Saturday and on a Sunday.
The Dark Manual is your third novel, but the other novels were not set in Japan.
No, I've been jumping around a bit with settings and genre too. My first novel was called Killarney Blues from my hometown in Killarney in Kerry. Which is kind of, it's a drama and a crime novel and a few things rolled into one. I've written a novel set in London, where I lived as well, and some of my work and two of my novels then have been set in Japan. So I've written about Ireland, Japan and England. So I've been jumping around from place to place, and genre too. I like to write a crime novel or a science fiction novel or a family drama. I get restless as a writer, so I like to keep hopping about.
So tell us about your Susie Sakamoto and how she came to live in Japan and how she came to have this houseboat.
The origin of the story started in a dream or a nightmare, actually. I had a terrible dream in 2017, a nightmare where I woke up sweating, that I had dreamt of this robot that I had programmed myself, and now the robot was trying to kill me. It was a terrifying dream. I woke up in the proverbial sweats, had breakfast that morning with my wife, and I was telling her about it. I said, look, I had a terrible dream last night. And she was like, that would make a really good science fiction movie. Why don't you write it? And I was like, that is a good idea. So I quickly set about writing it as a screenplay, which I do with all my novels. I write them as a screenplay first, which becomes kind of an outline for me, and I'm able to picture the whole movie in my head that way. And then I had the screenplay finished within a month or two, and then I started to novelize that. Susie, I changed from a first person narrative of my own weird dream into a female character, and the Susie came alive for me. She took over, and it just took on a life of its own then. And a lot of it is based on my own experiences in Japan, you know, sometimes feeling isolated, sometimes feeling difficulties with the language, as Susie does in the novel and in the TV series too. So a lot of it is based on my own experiences. But of course, the robot, clearly not. That was something that came in the dream, and something that I thought would be the hot topic. You know, AI is a hot topic everywhere now, and I thought I was onto something, and well, it's kind of worked out that way, thankfully.
Indeed it has. And that idea of Susie, yes, she's isolated because her Japanese isn't very good, but then this devastating thing happens where her husband yeah. and child disappear, feared or thought to be dead. And then she suffers this severe grief, which in the series is very poignant. But it's also because she lapses into alcoholism and over drinking and bad temper to the robot. It gives the thing an awful lot of humour as well. Was that in the novel?
I think so. Yeah, I think the novel was probably a little bit darker. When I heard that it was going to be made into a TV series, and I'd spoken with the scriptwriter, and they were pitching it as a dark comedy, and I was like, comedy? Really? In my head, it was more of a kind of a Handmaid's Tale, very dark, 1984-ish kind of thing, you know, prescient about AI and the future and so on. But then going back through the novel, I thought, yeah, she is quite sarcastic at times and quite snarky. And there are a few humorous elements that perhaps I missed in my own reading first time around. And that has carried through to the TV show, too. They've got a nice balance. I've only seen the first two episodes the same as everybody else. But I think the balance is really good in it. It is dark. It is mysterious. It is harrowing at times in the sense that it is about a grieving mother. But it's retained a sense of humor, and Sonny brings a lightness of tone to it as well. I mean, Sonny, the character, the robot character.
Yeah. What do you think of Sonny? Is it like what you imagined?
Not at all. Again, in my dream, in my imagination, and in the novel, it was a very dark character. Even the eyes were glowing ominous red, and was quite an evil thing, you know. And then when I was presented and actually met Sonny for the first time in 2022, when I was invited onto the set in Tokyo, and I met Sonny for the first time, and, you know, there was a big bright face with, you know, what a lot of people are saying is like a big emoji face coming at you. And I was like, wow, that's not what I had expected at all. But it's a nice surprise, you know, and a lot of, I've learned that I've had to let go of a lot, you know, my own preconceptions and knowing that scriptwriters and TV people, they're going to take your work and take it in a completely different direction. And that's fine. You just got to let them do their thing. And it's working out fine, you know.
And did you meet Rashida Jones?
I did. I met her first time on the set, and I met her again a few weeks ago when we had there was a launch party. My wife and I were invited down to Tokyo by Apple TV for the launch of the series, and Rashida was back doing interviews and stuff, and I met her again, and she's great. She's a true pro.
She's not Irish though, like your original character.
No, they decided to change that. Yeah, the original story was an Irish woman, a red-haired Irish woman, pretty stereotypical. And when they bought the rights, they said they wanted to change it to an American woman and change from Susie with an S to Susie with a Z. And I said, yeah, okay, that's fine. Okay.
So as you said, there's the vista of AI, there's, you wonder, even in the series, not to mind in your book, there is a feeling that perhaps the robot is being controlled by a larger force rather than some domestic appliance in the house. We feel that the corporation that Susie's husband worked for is less than benign.
Yeah, I think there was that fear and trepidation when I was having the dream, like who is controlling what kind of thing? And that was something I wanted to maintain while I was writing. And I think there's also a mention in the novel, as far as if I can remember correctly, to the Wizard of Oz, which was something that's always stuck with me ever since I saw the original movie back in the day, or read the original story back in the day, of someone pulling the strings from behind, you know? And the Wizard of Oz, of course, spoiler alert, it turns out to be no great wizard at all, but a little man behind the screen kind of thing. And I've always been fascinated by that notion.
And as you said, Colin, you've seen two of the episodes. And have you chatted to the scriptwriters? Do you know, have they confided in you as to how much they've changed of your novel?
Yeah, Katie Robbins is the showrunner and scriptwriter, and she's been forthright and very open about everything right from the beginning. You know, we collaborated in the sense that we talked about it. And when I first met her, she said, well, this is the way I'm going with this. And is this okay by you kind of thing? And I was like, sure, of course. And she sent me the first four scripts when they were written. And it was surprising that they just started to take it off in their own direction. But like I said, you know, you just got to let it go and let them do their thing. You know,
Colin, you have a thing about animals in your book, and there are owls in the Dark yeah. Manual. I haven't seen an owl yet, but I'm three episodes in, so I might just.
Well, here's
they
the
mightn't
thing.
Come
You're
yet.
Not, you're not going to see an owl, and that was one of my questions. Funnily enough, I had this very same conversation yesterday with a friend of mine. We went for coffee, and she's like, "No owls yet. I'm waiting for the owls. One of the owls coming." And I said, "I'm sorry to disappoint, but I asked Katie, the scriptwriter, are there owls in it?" And they said, no, they decided not to put any in and not go with that direction at all, which was really one of the disappointing factors for me, because that's one of my favorite parts of the novel. And yeah, it was quite a disappointment.
And Colin, how has the series gone down in Japan?
Yeah, it's been, the reviews generally have been very, very positive with friends and everybody that I've talked to here, as well as critics and newspaper and media outlets and so on. I think people here are happy that it's showing Japan in a very interesting light, that a lot of Japanese shows that are shown in the West tend to be, oh, look how strange the Japanese are. Oh, and don't they do funny kind of things, you know, and aren't they all a bit weird sort of thing, you know, often in a kind of a disparaging tone. But now with this, they're happy that they're showcasing the best of Japan, and the fact that it's a global collaboration between America and between Japan. And even a lot of the crew that I met on set that day, a lot of them were from Canada, from Vancouver. Sunny itself, the robot, was made in New Zealand by the team who made Lord of the Rings, so that company. So it's a global collaboration.
Colin O'Sullivan, thank you so much for talking to us on Arena. And Sunny is streaming on Apple TV. Music Town is the annual music festival that brings artists together in the National Concert Hall for a celebration of collaboration and experimentation. Curated by Leagues O'Toole and David Connaughton, this year's programme brings us performances such as Soda Blonde and the National Symphony Orchestra and Mohammed Skaifa Khan and the Crash Ensemble. This Sunday, the NCH, at 4 p.m, Harp Ireland presents Moods, a trio recital for harp, electronic music and dancer, featuring harpist Aisling Ennis, sound artist Peter Power and choreographer Robin Byrne. And I'm delighted to be joined now in studio by Aisling Ennis and her beautiful harp. Describe your beautiful harp, Aisling.
So the harp I'm playing on this evening is an Irish-made Irish harp by Tomás McGilligode, and is called Lazarus because Lazarus went through death and resurrection to be here in front of you. It's a harp that's built with, I suppose, it's especially highly strung so that I can kind of lash into it and get lots of different sounds and colours. So
yeah, because you tuned, then you went out for a break, and now you've come in and you had the key out again.
Oh,
so it
yeah.
is temperamental.
Very temperamental, as a cat, but hopefully... sounds a bit nicer.
It is a beautiful thing, though. Now, tell us a little bit about this piece that you're going to do in Music Towns. It's highly experimental, isn't it?
It's a bit of crack, yeah. So I suppose at the heart of it, we're taking some structure from existing repertoire for the harp. So there'll be a bit of solo harp going on, and the harp enjoys a very broad and varied repertoire that we dip into a little bit. And then I suppose we use those as jumping off points to improvise together and to step a little bit very much into the ether.
Because Robin is there at his mixing desk and he is creating something live. And then you're playing and responding to that, is
yeah,
that right?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. So Peter will be sometimes improvising alongside what I'm doing. Other times he might be using the sound from the harp to initiate lots of other digital and electronic sounds. And while this is going on, Robin is very much sort of navigating her way through the music in real time.
Yes. Robin is the dancer. She is responding in dance form, and it's Peter is at the not distorting, but having fun with whatever you're playing.
Yeah,
but as you say, there are signposts along the way.
There are
milestones along the way, and you're going to start with one of those pieces.
I am. So this is an 18th century Highland tune called the Mermaid Song. It's a tiny little thing, really. And I suppose I was fascinated by it and by Unwaith an Wara and the murky depths of, you know, where she comes from and the story of that. So, yeah.
OK, let's play it and we can chat about it.
OK.
Wonderful, the mermaid song there. Aisling, there is so like depths of the sea. You feel down there with all the people with tails, all the wonderful mermaids.
I played it for my children before I left and they said they thought it was creepy. So I suppose there is darkness in there in the story of Unwaith an Wara and her cloak and
tell us the story. This is the story of the seal that turns into a woman, falls in love, or a man falls in love with her and then takes her magic cloak. Is that right?
That's right. So there are so many versions of this story that crop up. But at the heart of it, there is a mermaid of some description and they have a magical cloak. And when they remove it, they turn into human form. And these mermaids were so beautiful that, you know, a fisherman might admire them from a distance and twig that if they steal the cloak, that she will remain in human form. And often they would bear children and they might discover the cloak hidden away and return to the ocean, return to the sea. And you know the way sometimes if you're out looking out at the ocean and you might see these sort of stacks or prominent rocks kind of jutting up out of the ocean. The story often goes that when she returns to the ocean, her children turn to stone. And so it's a beautiful and kind of heartbreaking, you know, often.
But you can definitely get that idea of something happening deep, deep in the sea from that music and maybe something going down into the sea then. I mean, it's very evocative, isn't it? And you can see how that would be a great starter for the improvisation that Peter and Robin will do.
Absolutely. I think I can't wait to get into the National Concert Hall and I highly recommend everyone have a look and see. There's so much going on at the weekend, spoiled for choice. And this year, you know, really the essence of all these incredible collaborations are being celebrated. I think collaboration and for me personally, improvisation opens a kind of another door. And so it's lovely to have these kind of moments that we can jump off from. And there's great crack between the three very different art forms and very different approaches. So I'm really looking forward to just sort of, I guess, it'll be a bit of an adventure, put it that way. So I'm really looking forward to see what comes.
And of course, there is a connection with Carlin and old music as well in this. You're very interested in these kind of mythological kind of creatures like fairies, for example.
Yeah,
yes.
I was very lucky. I received funding from Wicklow Arts Office to do a lot of a kind of a dream project looking into all things fairy music. I play the Irish harp, and the connection and the importance of the harp within our Irish kind of lore goes way back to the Tuatha De Danann. But equally within the classical repertoire, the 19th century saw this fairy hysteria take the world by storm. And I don't think it's just by accident that there was this mass exodus of the Irish people after the famine. We took our stories and our tunes and our beliefs, you know, with us. So yeah, I mean, it was great fun. And of course, one of the kind of the top hits when you're looking into Kyol Shi is purportedly Turlough O'Carolan's first tune, his first composition. So he wrote, you know, well over 200 that we have today. And the story goes that he was told a fairy story about two warring clans of fairies in County Leitrim, Sí Beag, Sí Mór. And that inspired the young Carolan to write his first tune and his first verse.
Well, you can't talk about it without playing it, can you?
I suppose I better. I'll give you a little bit. I'd be rude not to.
Beag, Sí Mór there from Turlough O'Carolan. And you still enjoy, even though you are a great modernist and improviser, you still like the tradition.
I do. I think there's you know, literal magic in the fairies. And I suppose having looked into so many beautiful tunes, Irish tunes, in so many of the collections, you know, and equally the wonderful repertoire for the concert harp. And I guess when you look at the 19th century as a period of time, and I imagine the grime of the Industrial Revolution, and, you know, can you imagine the sight of a harp coming out and playing this ethereal music at that time? So I think the poor old fairies now, of course, they couldn't quite make it through World War One. So our fascination and this huge kind of international hysteria about all things fairy, it dies away with World War One.
So, and is that because things just got too bleak? And they,
I think the there was just such a loss of life, and I think a loss of innocence as well. So there's something. It's a kind of a golden moment in terms of the repertoire.
Now, talking about things traditional and things old, you're also designing a QR code for this fairy harp, Kyol Shi.
Yeah, that's right.
You're going all super modern about this. So how does that work, and what are you doing exactly?
I suppose the idea came from the fact that, you know, everybody has a device in their pocket on the go. Usually it's in their hand, even when they're out on their daily or weekly walk. And so the QR code recital is very simply a number of signs placed in nature. And when a person clicks on the QR code, they get a little snippet, a little bite-sized version of some of the music and some of the ideas that went into the fairy harp, Kyol Shi.
Excellent. So we're going to play then some from your album, and this is called The Folly of Melancholy. Talk us into this track.
I suppose in the spirit of improvisation, I just had a quiet knowing that when I had these kind of dates booked, very excited to work with Leisha O'Brien and Ben Rawlins, that I just wanted to see what would bubble out. And so the album really is just a collection of what bubbled out on those days in September of 2021.
wonderfully complex piece, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that easy to play?
To be honest, I just sort of played where my hands fell. You know, it was a very liberating feeling to just see what came out. There was huge catharsis in it. So nothing felt difficult because it was just a release, you know, an expression. And so I think back very fondly of it. And I suppose there will certainly be an element of that on Sunday, but in the gorgeous company of Peter Power and Robin Byrne.
Fantastic. Aisling Innes, thank you for coming in and sharing your live music with us as well as listening to your album. Aisling Innes, who along with sound artist Peter Power and dancer and choreographer Robin Byrne will perform in the cross-disciplinary collaboration at the National Concert Hall this Sunday at 4 p.m. as part of the Music Town Festival. Full details from musictown.ie.